Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's virtual event. This afternoon, August 26th, we discuss taxation by international consent. My name is Evelyn Hildebrand, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us a very distinguished panel, and we're very pleased to welcome this group of scholars and experts to discuss this afternoon. I will introduce our moderator very briefly, Professor Jeremy Rabkin. Professor Rabkin is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University, and he's also a member of the Federalist Society's International and National Security Practice Group. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will have an opportunity for the audience to send in questions. The methods for asking questions, you can either send in a question via the Q&A chat, the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. So that's to the left of the chat box, it's the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. Or if you would like to ask a question verbally, then you can press the raise hand button also at the bottom of your screen, and you'll have an opportunity to speak live. Either of those options are available to you, although you can enter Q&A questions anytime during the presentation. With that, thank you very much to our panelists for being with us today. Professor Rabkin, the floor is yours.
Okay, I'm just gonna start by reviewing who the panelists are in a just very quick, sketchy way, because they're all on Google and you can read all about their achievements and interesting things they've done if you want to pursue that. And then I'll give a brief sort of setup, and then we'll have some discussion with Mike Ramsey, and then with Josh Wu, and then with Steve Krasner. So just briefly, Michael Ramsey is professor at the University of San Diego Law School, where he is a specialist on constitutional issues involving foreign affairs. He's written a lot about that. Josh Wu was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department in the previous administration in the Tax Division, and is now a partner at Latham & Watkins in Washington. Steve Krasner is a professor of international relations at Stanford and has written a lot about sovereignty and difficulties with coordinating global policies. So let me start just by setting the background to all this. In the late 1990s, when we'd had a decade of economic growth and development of markets in new areas, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is basically an organization representing more advanced developed economies, they issued a warning against what they called harmful tax competition. Some countries were taxing too little, and that was really unfair because you would lose businesses which would go to the low tax jurisdiction, and something should be done about that. They started raising that cry in the late 1990s. About a decade later, people looked up and said, whoa, some countries are claiming to be based in a low tax jurisdiction where they actually have very little presence on the ground. They just claim to be based there. And people realized, the internet has made it possible to situate yourself in a place where you're not actually much on the ground. There was a discussion about this starting in 2017. The OECD sponsored discussions about what they call digitalization, meaning companies that can do a lot of online business. And it's sort of unclear who gets to tax this business, because you can do business in a place where you're not physically present. Since 2017, The OECD has sponsored a discussion on two tracks, or what they call two pillars, to try to work up an international agreement to deal with these challenges. Pillar one, as they call it, is about trying to get common rules on where we should say particular corporate activities are based in the era of digitalization. And pillar two, global minimum tax. There are a lot of technical details here, which is why the discussions have gone on for quite a while and probably will continue for a while. But the Biden administration has expressed particular enthusiasm for pillar two, the global minimum tax, because it is advocating for an increase in the U.S. Corporate tax. The U.S. corporate tax is now 21%, and the Biden proposals to raise it to 28%. So that's a considerable jump. There are countries that are quite a bit lower. Ireland is at 12%. And then there are some countries, tax havens like Barbados, 5%. The Cayman Islands, 0%. So you could see different countries have different stake in this. But the OECD has gathered now 135 countries, I think, to participate in discussions. The majority are not members of the OECD, but they just want to be part of the discussions. And the expectation is there may be something which is called a treaty or a convention or an agreement, but if it were really a treaty, probably we couldn't get two-thirds support for it in the United States Senate. So there's been discussion that it could be called an agreement and the United States would just implement it. We would have to pass legislation to raise our taxes and to assert tax jurisdiction in ways that have been proposed under this agreement. I should just mention quickly, one of the levers here is the global minimum tax idea under pillar two. The general idea is if a country taxes corporate activities in its jurisdiction at less than 15%, the home country of a corporation doing business there can tax whatever is left over. So if it's Ireland at 12%, you could add 3%. If it's the Cayman Islands, and we were the home country, we could add 15% to that. So it's a discouragement to going to a low tax jurisdiction, so you're going to have to pay anyway. That kind of tax, let's call it, some people already have called it topping up, would still require Congress to enact the tax. No one's saying this would be imposed just because President Biden signed an agreement. But it's still a very interesting constitutional question. Should the agreement have any effect at all on the way we look at this legislation? And since Michael Ramsey has written a lot about this, I want to start with him. You published a piece a few years ago saying there's not really a constitutional problem with the Paris Climate Accords because they're not binding. And it's not really a problem with the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action, the so-called nuclear deal with Iran, because it's not really binding. And I want to just start by asking you now, do you still have that opinion? But yes, those were okay constitutionally because they were just handshakes.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks to the Federal Society for having me on this. And thank you for asking a question that doesn't involve tax, because I should say at the outset, I don't know anything about tax, but I do know at least a little bit about treaties and non-binding agreements, because I have written a little bit about that. So in answer to your question, yes, I think that is still my view. And I think it's I'm pretty confident of that. And just some quick constitutional background. As we know, the Constitution provides for treaties through Article 2, Section 2, that the president negotiates and then will make a treaty with the advice and consent of the Senate. But a essential attribute of a treaty is that it is a binding commitment in international law. That's the way treaties were understood at the founding. If you look at the great international law writers of the 18th century, like Vattel, it's very clear that that was the sort of the essential attribute of a treaty, is that it is binding. And so when you have an agreement that is not binding, when it's just sort of aspirational, expresses a goal, but it doesn't purport to invoke international law as sort of its making it a commitment in the formal sense, then it doesn't become a treaty.
Yeah.
And because it doesn't become a treaty, it doesn't implicate the treaty clause. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to push you a little on this. I understand that it may be hard to draw sharp lines, bright lines, and I certainly understand that there is a realm of diplomatic discourse in which the president is photographed with the other members of the G7 or the G20, and they all say in their final statement, we all agree to do more in dealing with climate change, or to do more against poverty, or to do more against medical threats. And they're just saying, and it doesn't have much meaning as any kind of obligation. But the Paris Climate Accord is very detailed, and people said when Trump withdrew on the grounds that it wasn't binding, so it doesn't matter, I can just leave. And people said, oh, this is terrible. The world thinks we're terrible. This has really undermined our international standing. And other countries did say, you let us down, how could you? So maybe it was, you're saying it's technically not binding, but maybe that's being too technical. And really, there was a kind of diplomatic commitment that made it difficult to withdraw. And I wonder if you have a way of explaining to us when that should be understood as more or less the equivalent of binding.
Sure. And I think a couple of thoughts. One is that I you may regard it as technical or formalistic, but I think there is a distinction between something that is a legal commitment and something that is not a legal commitment, but nonetheless is potentially something that if you go back on it, people will be unhappy with you about it, diplomatic commitment, as it were. The second aspect of that is probably a question that's better addressed to Professor Krasner than to me, because I'm a lawyer, not an international relations person. I think when you bring international relations into it, there is a sense in which, sure, that when the president says something on behalf of the United States, even when it's not even in the core sense of an agreement, but he just says, we're going to do this, and then turns out he doesn't, then that can have implications for our international relations, for our standing in the world, and so forth. But none of those are legal consequences. And so I would distinguish between a legal equipment, a legal commitment, and one that's not. Let me just say real quickly, though, I do think that it is. You are right in saying that sometimes it's not an obvious distinction, and in particular with respect to both the nuclear agreement with Iran and the Paris Accord. And I said this in the article that I wrote about those two, is that there were concerns. Because it was not made as clear as I would have liked to see it made, that the U.S. president understood those agreements as non-binding. And indeed, there was some confusion with our agreement partners as to whether it was really intended as a binding agreement or not. And I thought there was some concern that the United States was trying to have it two ways. That is saying, for domestic purposes, oh, this is non-binding, so we don't have to worry about the treaty clause. But for international purposes, oh, we are making this commitment to you, with a sort of overtone that at least an implication that it was an international law commitment. I think we need to be very careful about that, because I think the president does risk overstepping constitutional bounds if he's not clear when something is binding and when something is not binding.
Yes. I just remind you and the listeners, you probably don't need to be reminded, but when the International Court of Justice said, oh, you cannot execute this Mexican national who was convicted in Texas on murder charges, we ended up saying, or the Supreme Court of the United States ended up saying, yeah, well, we promise to undertake to comply with decisions of the International Court of Justice, but that didn't mean we're legally bound to do it, so we're not doing it. I've oversimplified the case a little bit, but you are talking as if, you know, once it's quote legal, and I think it's extremely ambiguous what it means to call it quote legal, right? And it might be something that courts might take into account in interpreting the meaning of subsequent congressional legislation, right? It's part of the legislative history that the president promised this to the G20 leaders and the OECD partners.
Sure, I think it could be taken into account in that way. But I think it, just to sort of complete the very big picture, constitutional picture. So the way that treaties become binding in the U.S. domestic system, of course, is through the Supremacy Clause, which says that the Constitution, statutes, and treaties are the supreme law of the land. Does not mention other kinds of international agreements, and in particular doesn't mention non-binding agreements. So the trade-off that a president faces in thinking about what sort of an instrument to use here, or at least were one trade-off, the constitutional trade-off, in my view, is that if the president wants to get an agreement that has legal force, and in particular if he wants an agreement that has legal force within the United States, within the United States domestic system, he has to go through the treaty power, which means he has to get two-thirds of the Senate. If he doesn't want to do that, he can make one of these non-binding commitments, but then it's nothing but a non-binding commitment. It's not an aspect of domestic law. And I on this point, I absolutely agree with President Trump that that President Trump could withdraw from the Paris Commitment. To the extent that the Paris Commitment was non-binding, that means it's not binding on subsequent presidents. In fact, I think it's not even binding on the current president. The current president could change his mind and say, well, I said I was going to do that, but now I've thought it over and I've decided I won't, because it's all in the realm of diplomacy rather than in the realm of law. And I think that's the crucial distinction here. And as long as that crucial distinction is made, I don't have a problem with the president saying, I want to achieve these kinds of goals. But if the president wants to achieve those kinds of goals as a legal matter within the U.S. system, he's either got to do it through the treaty power, meaning two-thirds of the Senate, or he's got to do it through the lawmaking power, meaning a majority of both houses of Congress. That's the way the Constitution's structured, and it makes perfect sense that if you're going to have something that has the force of law, you need a substantial participation of the legislative branch. If you're going to have something that's just a diplomatic instrument, then the head of diplomacy is the president, and it's fine for him to do that.
Yeah, he of course will want to say that it's both.
Yes, of course, and that's I think the key point. And again, that's the respect in which I found the two agreements we were talking about to be somewhat problematic. Though I think in respect, particularly to the Iran deal, the Paris deal is a little closer question. If you really examine them, they really were non-binding commitments. And so that's why I ultimately, in my article about them, concluded they were constitutional. But I think there is a potential problem, as I said, and I think that's to tie it to the current situation. I think that's what we want to have an eye to, is that to what extent is the president, if the president proceeds with agreements on these on this tax matters, is the president trying to have it both ways? Is he trying to fudge this distinction between binding and non-binding? I think absolutely that distinction cannot be fudged, or should not be fudged, because it is in fact an essential constitutional distinction.
Yes. All right. Let me ask some questions to Josh Wu, who has knows a lot about tax. So the first thing I want to ask you, which is maybe not directly in your experience, but you must be aware of this. It seems to me when we enact tax bills, it's very hard to get Congress to stick to proposals from the Treasury, because Congress enjoys refining and improving and elaborating and complicating the tax code. When the president negotiates a trade agreement, we have in past decades gotten Congress to commit itself to an up or down vote on what we used to call fast track. And the idea behind that was nobody will negotiate with us if Congress takes a trade agreement and then starts pulling it apart and taking things out and adding other things that weren't in the agreement. How hard do you think it will be to get Congress to enact legislation that stays within the parameters of an OECD agreement, assuming the world gets to that in the next year or two?
That's a great question. I think the bottom line answer is it will be difficult. I mean, tax legislation, because tax impacts so much of the economy and there's so many competing interests in different regions, in different states, and depending on what industries particular legislators may be interested in, you know, tax bills tend to have a lot of back and forth and additions and removals. And it's not just about the rates, it's about the exclusions and the industries that get exempted, and it's about the thresholds. And so because of that, it's hard to imagine that the U.S. could simply push through something through the Senate and the House, you know, based on an OECD model without significant negotiation back and forth. I will say that the way that the G7, G20 have sort of positioned this proposal, at least specifically with respect to Pillar 2, the global minimum tax, is to allow some flexibility. I think they realize that they need the U.S. to play along. They need the U.S. to be part of this. I mean, this really stalled until the U.S. sort of got back in the game. And so they've built in the acknowledgement that, look, you're going to have to implement this sort of as a framework, and then the specifics are up to you, you know, each country. And so knowing that it's not going to be 100% aligned, especially on Pillar 2, I think that left some room to recognize that fact, that the U.S. can't simply pass this through as is.
If it does actually, there is this agreement and it is implemented by the U.S. Congress, what do you think would be the greatest challenge in enforcing it? Like, say there are countries that say, okay, 15%, that's what we're doing, 15%. But of course, we have our own definition of what is income and we have our own deductions. But the rate is going to be 15%. How would we certify or determine for ourselves what they're doing in some other country?
Right. And that's the big question, right? From a tax practitioner standpoint, that's, I think, the big concern for both, should be the concern for both the tax administrative agencies like the DOJ and the IRS, but also for taxpayers that need certainty when they're structuring their operations, when they're figuring out where to place their IP. They need to know how the rules are going to work and, you know, how foreign countries are going to treat different things. And so that's been the struggle of the last decade, really starting in 2010, is how does the U.S. gain insight into what other countries are doing? How do we characterize their law? Because like you said, they can have a 15% tax rate on paper, but there's all kinds of ways that other countries can effectively reduce that rate if they want to incentivize companies to move there, as they've done in the past, right? Yes. And so through rebates and credits and other types of incentives, they can effectively reduce that 15% rate. It falls then on the U.S. and what I expect will be litigation, depending on how this is structured, to look at those exemptions, credits, rebates, and say, what is this? Under a U.S. law perspective, what does this mean? And there have been, over the last decades, numerous cases where you've seen experts coming in to testify on foreign law and the parties in briefs disputing what a particular tax or credit or exemption means under foreign law and how that impacts the U.S. tax system. So I do think the administrability will be challenging, and there's no doubt that countries will try to play games to, you know, cooperate, but also incentivize, you know, U.S. companies to move operations to their shores. So it's certainly something that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. And this, if this comes to pass, it's presumably in the context of we're going to increase domestic taxes, but we're going to try to block the exits. We're going to make it more difficult for you to avoid paying the U.S. tax because we're going to make sure that you can't get to a foreign country where it's less. And maybe if, you know, we're talking about a sizable increase, like whatever that is, 30% increase or so, maybe that's enough incentive to start exploring murky depths of opaque foreign tax law, right?
It might, I mean, it's certainly enough incentive to try. And I think, you know, I understand the administration's idea here. And both administrations of the last two administrations have been concerned with shifting income to low tax jurisdictions. And both have tried different proposals to prevent things like inversions of corporate structures, to stop companies from moving assets abroad, right? And so this will help that effort by raising the sort of worldwide global tax rate. There's less incentive to move abroad. You know, as sort of we've talked about before, I mean, you can wonder why other countries might be interested in this, right? I mean, thinking, gee, we can't lower our tax rate anymore and attract investment and attract U.S. companies to come over here and move their operations. And that's where Pillar One really comes in, is shifting the allocation so that those other countries where the U.S. is selling goods and services into those countries can get a share of that tax. Where under existing tax treaties, generally, they don't get a share of that if the U.S. company doesn't have what's called a permanent establishment or a nexus or a physical presence to that country. So I view this as there's a U.S. positive portion for Pillar Two, the global minimum tax, but it probably only works globally if the world gets Pillar One, which allows some other countries to get some of that money from U.S. corporations. So there's an interesting relationship here. It's not just about the administrability of Pillar Two and the global minimum tax. It's how do we administer Pillar One, which is far more complex.
Yes. So you mentioned the tax treaties. Mike Ramsey might have an opinion about this also, but let me start with you. So we have these treaties. My understanding is that they are self-executing. They actually are law of the land. We have a lot of them, like 60 of them, with major trading partners, major Western countries. Although, interestingly, when I looked, we actually have them with countries you wouldn't think it was urgent for us to come to an agreement with, like Belarus. Like Americans earning profits in Belarus should be, I think, sent to the FBI or some intelligence agency. Forget about the IRS. But anyway, we have these 60 agreements out there. What would be the relation between subsequent legislation implementing this agreement and the tax treaties? Does it mean that the tax treaties can just be disregarded because we have a later law? Or how will these things come together, particularly if you're a judge in litigation that involves both a treaty and the new legislation under this new international agreement?
Well, I'll take a stab at this, but I will defer any constitutional issues to Professor Ramsey because that is not my area of expertise. I do think, so looking at this, and this will result in litigation because it's hard to imagine a way that Congress can enact this by statute that will not impact the existing network of tax treaties. I mean, that's simply not possible in my view. And so then the question becomes, you know, usually you would say, well, they both have the force of law. The one that's later enacted, of course, controls. But the conflict I see is, you know, usually tax legislation, again, there's a lot of different moving parts to it. But I've never seen one before that's going to have to address the numerous treaties we have. In other words, every treaty, although we do have a U.S. model treaty, but everyone is slightly different. slightly different definitions, slightly different rules, slightly different things about what constitutes residence or what constitutes a permanent establishment in a foreign country. So if Congress passes a statute enacting, you know, Pillar 1 and or Pillar 2, the question is, does that override specific portions of the treaties, or does certain portions of the treaty remain intact? And I think most courts are going to be reluctant to simply write over a treaty that's been negotiated and has been in place and relied upon for years without trying to deconflict it with the later in time statute. That is where the rub is going to be in the litigation, and where you could see a lot of future, you know, conflict between various treaties and the legislation. And it can't be resolved in one case because there are so many treaties, as you pointed out, with all different kinds of countries that themselves have different tax systems. So like I said, as a tax practitioner, I mean, it's interesting and it could be fun for litigation, but as a tax policy matter, it presents some challenges for sure.
I noticed in doing a little homework for this that there is an international convention, defining taxable assets, but we're not a party to it. We don't like to standardize. We do these things one by one in our bilateral relations. My friends, do you
I thought I'd just jump in real quick, although I don't have much to add. I think what we heard is absolutely right. Again, I'm not thinking of it in terms of tax treaties. I'm thinking of it in terms of big picture law of treaties. There are two basic principles in considering the relationship between statutes and treaties within the U.S. domestic system. The first is that as you've just heard, the later in time governs. They're considered to have equal status, statutes and treaties. So the later in time governs. So if there's a later statute that overrules an earlier treaty, then too bad for the treaty, statute prevails. But there's a countervailing interpretive convention, which says that a statute will not be construed to overrule a treaty unless it's clear. The problem is that those two things point in opposite directions. So unless Congress is extremely careful and clear about what it's doing, and far be it from me to say Congress wouldn't do that, but if they were not careful and clear, then there's going to be, as you heard, substantial opportunities for litigation, because basically one side can argue the later in time rule, the other side can argue the clear statement rule, and you can take your pick. The one other thing I'd add about this that's relevant is that while it is true in U.S. domestic law that statutes and treaties have equal status and therefore the later in time governs, this is not true in international law. In international law, the treaty remains a binding obligation, and it is not a defense to say that you have overridden it by statute within your domestic legal system. So the other party to the tax treaty might well have grounds to complain unless we had worked it out with them in advance as to how this is supposed to work.
Do either of you happen to know whether there are arbitration clauses in these tax treaties?
I know nothing about tax treaties.
Well, so that the other party can say, we insist on submitting this to arbitration because you've now violated the terms of this tax treaty.
I defer to the tax expert.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know. That's never come up just in practice. Usually the issue we see is a challenge between the two countries about who gets to tax what. Yep. So there is a process in the treaties to resolve that, where you have both countries saying, we want to grab, you know, this manufacturing, and so we have to negotiate a resolution. But if one party blatantly violates the treaty, I don't know. I've not seen that in practice.
Well, okay. So this can all be complicated. Let me pose some questions to Steve Krasner. Just a small thing to start with. I was struck that this starts off as an OECD undertaking. So the OECD now has 38 members. And then they said, whoever is interested can be part of this negotiating a new framework. And that is, I think, 138. I mean, it's a big group of countries. And if you look at the countries that are participating, it's tax havens. The Cayman Islands are like, yeah, we want to be involved in negotiating. Bermuda, Bahamas. They all want to be part of this negotiation. Is that surprising to you, or would you say, oh, yes, that's what an IR scholar would expect?
I think the OECD is an organization that's always looking for something to do.
Yes.
It was established after the Second World War. You know, it was originally set up to reconstruct Europe. It's basically been an organization that's tried to find something to do. Tax havens look like something to do. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an expert on taxation. But am I surprised by the OECD doing this? No, not really.
No.
Because I think that's
that I get totally. My question is, why do tax haven states that are not OECD members say, oh, thank you, we want to participate in this negotiation?
So I think, if I could step back for a second, you know, we have this sovereign state system. It's developed in Europe over several hundred years. It's really kind of odd when you think about it. And, you know, why does China and Vanuatu have the same number of votes in the UN General Assembly? It's kind of strange. And there have been other ways in which the international system was organized. If we look at China, traditionally China was the center. Everybody else was a tributary state. It actually makes, in some ways, much more sense. So I think if you're looking at, you know, I tried to do a little research on tax havens. So look, if you're going to put a large amount of money someplace, you want to make sure that place has some kind of system that's relatively stable. So basically, I think if you look at the sovereign state system, it's kind of safe to do things which they wouldn't do otherwise in only two ways. One is you have a hegemon providing collective goods. It's simply not clear that the United States can play that role anymore. The second thing is that you've been able to pressure other states to act in ways in which they would not otherwise act. Now, you might do that by suing their banks rather than by suing them. Now, I think that, you know, having the OECD do this and set it as a target may make some sense, but it will require a whole bunch of national legislation. And the problem will be, I mean, to get national legislation, which is mutually compatible and which every country would see as being acceptable. I can't see the U.S. playing this hegemonic role, and I can't see the U.S. bringing enough pressure to actually make change possible.
Yeah, I mean, this was my impression.
So I think it will be hard. I think what they've done makes sense. It's sort of setting a goal. It's non-binding. But actually making anything like this work will require legislation from many different countries. And there, it will have to be in their self-interest to do it. You know, I mean, Ireland or Apple might do this because, you know, for one reason or another, but Ireland because it's, you know, other members of the European Union might threaten them, Apple because, you know, if they get a reputation for being tax dodgers, that's not a great thing for selling $1,000 iPhones, but it will not be easy.
Yeah, I wonder if you're even right that it's bad to have a reputation as a tax haven. I think many countries would love to have that reputation.
Well, I think the problem is
photographed in the New York Post as a tax haven.
No, I think being a tax haven isn't bad. And the question is whether, you know, the country that's really in charge is going to impose restrictions or not. And that will depend on domestic politics and domestic politics in a lot of different countries.
Yes. And I wonder whether the United States is prepared to make this a priority. I mean, one of the countries that's actively participating in this is China. And I'm kind of skeptical that this will be high, you know, if we do not have another Trump administration. I do not say this at all in praise of the previous administration, but I just think subsequent administrations won't be so focused on, wait, were there American companies that were doing business in China that was not as heavily taxed as it otherwise might have been under this agreement?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I think the problem, what I've been thinking about lately is, on the one hand, we have this covered say system. On the other hand, we have a disconnect between underlying capabilities and the ability to do harm. That's a much bigger problem. You think about Iran or North Korea, you know, 500 years ago, they wouldn't have been much of a threat. I mean, now they're a gigantic threat. So there are bigger questions. Although
they are probably not a threat to become tax havens.
No, they might not become tax havens, but I mean, if you look at North Korea, some fracture of 1% of the GNP of Japan or Russia or China or the United States, but it killed millions of people. If you go back 500 years or 1,000 years, that was not going to happen. Basically, you won wars by having more people or a larger GNP. It's no longer the case. So I think there are big questions that are very problematic.
Yes, I see that. Do you think there's any chance that, let's say, 25 years from now, we'll look back on this agreement and say that was the beginning of a new era in international cooperation?
Okay, I think unlikely. As I said, I think, you know, we've gotten international cooperation in two ways, either by being a hegemon, which the United States is not at this point, and even if it were, it's not clear to me how it would act, or by putting pressure on other states. I don't think it's going to be in the interest of countries to do that. So, no, I don't think we'll get a new era. I think they started the only way they could possibly start, which is by having aspirational objectives and targets, you know, rather than legislation. And I don't think we failed to have a treaty because, you know, not only would it be hard to get a treaty enacted in the United States, but a treaty is unlikely to work. So I think the best you could have is aspirational targets. And here, I mean, the answer to your question is it depends. It depends on what? It depends on domestic politics, which I actually don't know well enough to know whether, if you look, you know, will Britain really find it to be in its interest to crack down on Jersey or Bermuda or someplace? I just don't know.
Yeah. It just strikes me that there's been a certain amount of political, let's call it political rage, that China or earlier Japan is producing things that's forced the closure of a factory in Wisconsin. And they can say, we used to make motorcycles and now we can't make motorcycles. And it's because of Japan underselling us. So we're angry at Japan. It's hard to believe that people will have that, perceive that kind of direct link between some bad thing happening in America and investment that leaks into other countries or like lesser tax.
All right. First of all, tax havens doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be producing things in other countries. You just have to have some entity which can try to profit out of it.
That's why it's hard.
And anything that requires more than two or three sentences to explain is too much.
Yes.
So I think these issues will be too complicated. They have sort of a modest degree of saliency. It will be difficult to see them getting a high degree of saliency.
Yes.
So I agree with you. I think, you know, it's going to be, you know, we have problems with China. I think they're real, but taxes is not going to be at the top of the list.
Yeah, that's my impression too. So we certainly have time if any of people in our audience want to raise a question. You can put it in the Q&A function, or you can raise your little blue hand and be called on. Okay, while we're waiting for them, do any of you want to correct anything that was previously said?
I actually have a question. because this is something, this is a constitutional treaty question specifically about tax. And so I'm going to ask Joshua Wu and just see if he knows. And I don't mean to suggest that you should know, but my question is, if they wanted, if the OECD wanted to do this as a treaty, as a self-executing, what the U.S. would call a self-executing treaty, that is, it's negotiated by the, or I mean, it would be developed in the OECD, then the United States would sign on the, if the Senate would ratify, if the Senate would give advice and consent, and then the president ratifies it in a traditional treaty process, then it's treated as non, as self-executing, becomes part of domestic law automatically. Seems to me that that would be the easiest way to do this, because then you don't get into this problem with the interaction between the statute and the treaty. I understand the political problems of doing it this way. My question is, if you know, is there any constitutional issue with that? Because on the one hand, people might say that a tax treaty that's self-executing interferes with Congress's ability to raise revenue on all revenue bills have to originate in the House. But on the other hand, we have all these tax treaties. So obviously you can do tax things by treaty. If is the understanding that that the Senate's treaty power with respect to tax is plenary and not limited by Congress?
That's a great question that I think is I don't know if there is an answer to that. I know that there is some scholarship in sort of the tax academia with respect to that, right? Does it, what's the interaction between the sort of the House's power and the Senate's power under treaty? It seems like, to a large extent, with these bilateral treaties, that has never, that's been sort of overlooked, or it hasn't really been addressed. And I think, just my suspicion, my personal view is, the reason that is because the tax treaties, it's with one treaty partner. It doesn't really impact the revenue overall of the U.S. to a great extent. Right. This would be fundamentally different, assuming, like you said, that they were to go with sort of a multilateral agreement. I mean, this would be a much more fundamental shift by treaty in the overall tax base and the revenue raised by the U.S. Now, the counter argument to that would be, look, the corporate tax rate and the corporate tax system is a relatively small percentage of the revenue that Treasury brings in. So most revenue is from, you know, employment taxes, from general income taxes. And so the corporate tax base is not a gigantic portion of what we collect. And so, you know, having this bilateral or this multilateral treaty, does that really impinge on sort of the role of the House in generating revenue? And you can make a sort of a proportionality argument there and say no more than the marginal changes that the treaties make when they give exemptions or give a special allowance for dividends or royalties or other kind of income. So I think that would be the counter. But I do think it's something that has not really been explored in the tax world, because it's never been on this scope. I mean, we don't do these kind of treaties. We do one-offs. We do tax information exchange agreements, bilateral treaties. You know, the closest thing when you were just talking about who's going to get on board with this, the closest thing I can think of in recent times to something like what the OECD is trying to do is FATCA, right? The Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, where the U.S. enacted a law and got all of these countries to do intergovernmental agreements with us based on our domestic law. And the way we did it was we said, if you don't get on board, we're going to withhold payments out of the U.S. And that's the stick, right? But that was a U.S. unilateral action that then prompted international action. And we had the domestic will after the Swiss bank scandals and all of the other publicity to do that. Like we were just talking about, I don't know if that exists now, if that political and that sort of momentum is the same as it was back in 2010.
Yeah, thanks. I'm guessing this is kind of a moot point because there wouldn't be the votes in the Senate to put this through as a treaty. But it struck me that would be if that would be the best way to do it if you could do it that way.
I'm just going to indulge the law professor temptation of, you know, complicating this. I have seen people making the argument the other way, which is you can't exclude the House because this is in effect a revenue bill. And so therefore we shouldn't do it as a treaty. We should do it as a congressional executive agreement because that would respect the special role of the House. But of course the people who are saying that are
also saying, this is a great thing, let's do it, and let's have a workaround of the Republican opposition in the Senate.
Well, I suppose at least under current law, you probably could do it that way. I myself have some reservations about congressional executive agreements under the original understanding of the Constitution. But in modern practice, we have lots of congressional executive agreements in the trade area, for example. So
why NAFTA is sort of unconstitutional, to coin a phrase.
Yeah. So I think you could do it that way if you did it as that, you know, the OECD would have the model treaty and then the president would sign on, and then this is the way it would come about, I think, is that then it would, the president could present it to Congress, to both houses of Congress, rather than presenting it to the Senate and say, I'm presenting this as a congressional executive agreement, like NAFTA, like the WTO, like the bilateral trade agreements. And there would be, I think, some people saying this is an extension of congressional executive agreements beyond what we've already done, and therefore it shouldn't be allowed because their constitutionality is suspect. And I might even be one of those people, but I think that would be a minority. I think most people would say, no, it's a congressional executive agreement. You could do it that way. So that's a good point, that maybe we should not be so quick to assume that we couldn't do it as a binding international agreement, because it is true that there are situations where you could use a congressional executive agreement to, in effect, bypass the treaty making power. It still, though, requires involvement of the lawmakers. And I'm not sure that even the House would be willing to go along with something the OECD came up with without making its own tweaks.
Let me ask this very, very particular question to Josh, where you may not know the answer. In Mike Ramsey's book, the Constitution's text in Foreign Affairs, he has a chapter with that name, why NAFTA is sort of unconstitutional. And he says at the end, well, it's sort of unconstitutional, but anyway, we can get out of it easily, so let's not make a fuss about it. It's not really that binding. We just like exit on 6-month notice. Of course, we don't yet have a treaty text for this OECD project, but is this the kind of thing that would provide for quick exit to reassure people like Professor Ramsey? Is that common in tax treaties to give you a quick exit provision?
No, I mean, if you look at the tax treaties, you'll see a lot of these treaties have been around for 30 plus years. And there's a reason they don't change, right?
Because people have to do long-term planning.
Exactly. Exactly. What do businesses need? They need long-term consistency. Yeah. And so, the worst thing is to give them an inconsistent tax position where they don't know what's coming next year.
So Professor Ramsey should not be so cavalier about this as he was about NAFTA.
Well, I don't know about that, but I would just say, I mean, in my view, there's so much power in the ability to tax, right? And so much ability to destroy or help a modern economy. So I just don't think, and it's not the kind of thing you can just change overnight. So I think it would be dangerous to say, let's do this, but we can back out. Because some of the changes that the OECD is proposing, especially on Pillar 2, Pillar 1, I think Pillar 2 might be easier to undo. Pillar 1 would not be easy to undo. I mean, that there are so many players that would be involved in allocating profits to different jurisdictions that you couldn't pull the plug on that overnight.
You're basically saying how these different jurisdictions will interlock when it comes to treating income as taxable in their jurisdiction. Yes,
exactly. Exactly. It's very much the analogy is the U.S. state and local system, right? Every state has its own taxing authority. It only works, and we only have consistency between the states to some extent, and there's plenty of litigation to say we don't have full consistency, but we have an overarching federal government and a constitution that gives us that unity. There's no such thing on the international context. And as you mentioned before, the U.S. has not been a part of a lot of these multinational understandings.
So let me pose to you the question that I posed earlier to Steve Krasner. If this thing does come off with the understanding that, of course, you can adapt it to your local priorities, and it's just a framework, but it does come off, and we have 135 countries signing up for it and accommodating the main elements of it, it seemed to me what you were just saying is we should expect it to have a fair amount of staying power, at least the framework of how we consider income being earned in different jurisdictions. And so maybe we would look back on this 25 years from now as, wow, the world became more standardized in the way revenue is raised.
That would not shock me. What would be shocking is if we had a multinational treaty, but it wouldn't be shocking if this did. So because there is a wave that's already been moving, as I mentioned, since FATCA, since the information exchange increases, since sort of automatic exchange of tax transparency that's been sort of pushed originally by the US and has sort of latched on in other places, it wouldn't surprise me if there's more agreement and consensus on what is income, where is income allocated.
Yes. So we will have a nuclear Iran, thanks to that agreement, which is okay because it's not really, you know, binding. And then we will have revived jihadi attacks around the world and a global tax cartel. And it would be really hard to figure out how they interact, but probably the jihadi jurisdictions won't become tax havens, so they'll be out of it. Or do you want to say, no, come on, cut it out. Those things are not really alarming, except for the nuclear Iran.
I was going to say, I'm not sure about the other one. They all sound pretty alarming to me. And I think, you know, there is the issue ultimately of giving up sovereignty of taxing authority. Yes. Is giving up a lot. That is giving up a lot. I don't think this will get that far, but it is something that would be concerning because defining income is a pretty fundamental portion of, you know, of the entire tax system. So that would be a very big concern. I don't think the U.S. is going to do that. Historically, we have not been willing to give up our ability to define what is income, and we're one of the few countries that still has a worldwide tax system, and we've never been fully willing to part with that.
Yes. So let me just say in conclusion, unlike some other things, this is not going to happen this year or even next year, right? But it could happen in President Biden's first term if he serves till the end of it, right? It could. I mean, so we're talking about like 3 years horizon. We're not talking 10-year horizon.
I think it'd be hard, but I think it'd be possible, in my opinion. I don't know what the others think.
Yeah. Well, I guess it may also depend on who's running Congress next year or the year after. People who are not paying attention to Afghanistan or people who are really still reacting to it. I mean, we don't know. Okay. Does anyone else want to make a comment? Because our FedSoc host wants to make a comment. Okay. Evelyn, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I just wanted to thank our panelists, since we're coming to the end of our program this afternoon, to thank our panelists and our moderator for your excellent discussion, and to let our audience know if you have any questions or feedback, comments, we welcome those comments at info@fed-soc.org. And if you've all had the opportunity or if you'd like to make any closing statements, you're welcome to. Otherwise, we will wrap up as it's getting to be the end of the hour. All right, I think we'll call that a day. In any case, tune in at 4 p.m. for our next webinar. And in the interim, we are adjourned. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.